Okay, yeah. I guess I had a really nice chat with one of the folks from the IAS group after the conference, and I know a couple of my collaborators, people I know well within LIGO, have been talking to this group as well. Just as an introduction then for anyone who sort of isn't following, in a series of recent papers, two methods papers and two result papers, a sort of group at IAS who haven't previously been involved in gravitational wave data analysis have claimed the observation of seven new binary black hole mergers on the data that LIGO's released through the Open Science Center. They've performed this using a new independently developed search algorithm, although I think they've clearly looked into the literature, and I would describe this as sort of building on work that's come before where they've gone, "That makes sense, that doesn't, let's do the things that are good." What I'm going to try and do here is just sort of go through a bit of a walkthrough of what they've done, give a little bit of an introduction to how this works in the first place, and then see if I can reproduce these results. Maybe we can learn a little bit more about whether a different search pipeline can also find that these are real or not. I want to say at this point, I had a really good chat when I've interacted with this group. They really, really know what they're doing. I shouldn't have to say things like this, but I think that some people have asked me that kind of thing, and really, they definitely know what they're talking about, and I've been really impressed that they've been able to develop something like this with the sort of timescale involved. I'm sure that we have stuff that we can learn from them, and probably vice versa as well, in terms of improving these things in the future, and maybe that can come out a little bit at the end. For those of you who haven't been doing this for the last decade, let me give a little bit of a recap as to how this kind of thing works. I've sort of cut some of this from talks that I've used before, where I've just tried to give a bit of an overview to how these searches work. I try to do this by firstly asking a few questions. Let's build the background first, right? Searching for colliding black holes, that's what we're trying to find. What do we know about the signal? What do we know about colliding black holes? Normally, I would go through sort of seven or eight slides talking about all this kind of stuff, but Alessandra's going to give a pretty detailed talk on this tomorrow, and I think people have probably heard a little bit about this kind of stuff in the workshop anyway. Let me summarize how well we know about the signals for the types of binary black hole merger that we've already seen, and the types of black hole merger that are being claimed as new detections, with two images. There's a signal, and it looks good, right? There's caveats, right? There's certain regions of the parameters, high mass ratios, highly processing systems. There's certain cases where we have a lot to improve, neutron star mergers where matter effects are important. But I think these kind of effects are away from the types of signals we've been observing to date, and the sort of any inaccuracy or uncertainties in the waveform model are probably pretty minor at this point and not sort of really affecting our ability, at least, to observe the types of signals that we've already seen. So I think asking questions about accuracy of waveforms probably comes somewhere else. But it is worth pointing out, and we should always remember, that compact binary mergers are described by a large number of physical parameters. Even if I ignore Richard and say eccentricity doesn't exist, which we generally do in search land, you still need 15 parameters. It's hard. We're working on it. That's another talk. You still need 15 parameters to fully describe the gravitational wave signal that would be emitted from a compact binary merger. Now, a lot of these parameters are degenerate with each other. We talked about the spins and the mass ratio being highly degenerate, which is why it's really hard to measure the mass ratio, because you don't know. You just measure some combination that comes out of this, and you generally measure in terms from the post-Newtonian expansion. There's also some extra information that comes from how the observer is oriented with respect to the source. So you've got both sort of parameters that are actually physical intrinsic to the source, and then sort of details about how you're observing the signal, where you are. If you're moving like Lisa does, then you have some information that's coming from that as well. But you do have to worry about this sort of 15-dimensional parameter space. That's probably a sort of very brief walkthrough about what we know about the signal. The other flip of that coin is the instrument itself. What do we know about the instrument that we're using to observe these types of signals? And what do we know about, effectively, the noise characteristics that come out once you start expressing the output of our detectors in terms of an effective gravitational wave strain? And there's a few key things that are important to remember here. One is that the noise curves, the sensitivity curves of LIGO and Virgo, are complicated. We often just draw these as a sort of curve that has a kind of a bucket and then it goes really high on other sides. But it isn't just that. There are numerous resonance lines that come from resonant beats of the harmonics, the calibration lines that we put in, the power line frequency you can clearly see at 50 hertz and then beats at 120 and 180 hertz. Laura should probably be doing this, not me, because I'm just making stuff up. Virgo has a hell of a lot of lines here that come from all sorts of resonances in the internal instrument. You can see there's sort of this comb that appears above here. But these kind of things are difficult because it means the noise becomes correlated over quite a large time scale, because if you sort of took the inverse Fourier transform of this, you get a correlation function that actually ends up being quite long. So you do have to worry about the fact that you have noise that's sort of correlated on a long time scale. It can be hard to remove this feature. We often want to talk about whitening the noise, moving it back to being Gaussian. To do that, you sort of have to almost undo this noise curve from the data. And to do that, you need to know the noise curve well, which is also difficult.
Okay, that's a stupid question. I understand LIGO in Hanford and Livingston at 60 hertz, but it looks like Virgo is 70 hertz instead of 50.
So Virgo has a beat here at 50 hertz, which is the power line.
Okay, that's down. Okay,
so there is also something else here at about 85, and I'm just going to look at Laura because she knows this better than me, but I've got no idea what it is.
I don't really know what Virgo the heck's doing.
Yeah, I don't know what that one is. This one and this one, I think, are the power lines and the harmonics that correspond to that, but there must be some other resonance that's come. I don't know what it is, some other resonance or line that's in there at 85.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think the suspension comes in higher.
So the giant thing that's just a little bit above the 60 hertz is something that's not power line or Virgo, then?
Yes.
Yeah, that one and that one are the two power lines.
There's like a huge amount of upconversion around the Virgo power line as well that makes it broader.
As well as a complex noise curve, the noise itself also isn't stationary. These things vary with time. Here's a plot that you can take from our public web pages showing the sensitivity of the instrument is public information. Here's just an example of the averaged range to binary neutron stars as a function of time over about 16 weeks in the first observing run. And the point is that this just isn't stable, right? It isn't a straight line across here. It's going up and down. There's times where the sensitivity is dropping right off when something just bad happens in a short region of time. But there's also a sort of slow roll as it changes. It changes over a week timescale. It changes over hour timescale. There's all sorts of differences going on.
So those points are integrated over an hour, or what is the integration?
These points, I think, are integrated over quite a short period of time.
60 seconds, I think. This is the sentinel plot from... So this is 60 seconds, and it's also the mean pass spectrum, which is why you get a lot of variation. So every time it drops down, there's a glitch in the data, basically, right, in the screen of the PSD. If you look at the current public pages, because we went over this in the talk, they are medians, so you don't see the glitches in the... But there's a few A-log entries that show the equivalent plot and the glitch rate you can see there as well.
Yeah, I mean, some of these times, certainly some of the worst will end up being removed from the analysis. So a lot of this is identified and flagged at generation time that it's bad, don't worry about it. But this is sort of almost a raw look at the data that's coming out that isn't at least just being thrown in the bin at generation time. But the point for the analysis, at least, is we have to worry about... We can't just measure this sensitivity curve once and forget about it. It is changing, and it is changing over a reasonably short timescale, which will become something we worry about. The other important point about our noise characteristics is that it is not Gaussian noise. It would be great if it was and could be described entirely by one of these noise curves over a sort of extended period of time. But if we look into the data, you can see numerous occasions where some non-Gaussianity happens, is picked up. Here's a set of examples of different non-Gaussian behaviors that happen. Some of these are understood. These sort of arches here are caused by some sort of light scattering that happens and causes this characteristic feature. Some of the other cases cause sort of shorter duration, almost blip-like things, and I think there's still a mystery as to what exactly causes these so-called blip glitches. The naming of these things becomes a bit strange. There is a website you can go to, Gravity Spy, where you can look over the data yourself and help us to classify these things. So I'd encourage people to play about and try and understand, help us a little bit in classifying this. But from the search perspective, we have to be careful to make sure that we are able to distinguish things that look like this from real soup.
I guess to what extent, they're presumably your housekeeping channels of all the locks and voltages on various bits of equipment in there. So are these identified by cross-correlating those, or is it just you want eyes staring at those and saying, that looks like this?
Oh, hello. We have a whole suite of tools that are looking for that correlation between auxiliary channels, i.e. things that will not show the gravitational wave signal, and things in the in the strain channel. Problem we've got is something like 10,000, 20,000 sensors, so it's about 100,000, 200,000 auxiliary channels per detector. So trying to find those correlations can be extremely difficult sometimes. Like the scattering, that one's easy. We can see that in some other places, but the blips, it doesn't show anywhere else. And it's so annoying.
And are those part of the public data, the IAS?
Yep. That stuff will be in there. If it's something that's easily
correlated.
The auxiliary channel.
So they just get the raw strain.
Oh, because it seems to me that
400,000 auxiliary channels.
But that seems like that might be a useful thing to do.
Absolutely.
When you get back to Caltech, walk into Alan Weiss's office and tell
him. It's a minor challenge for people with these kind of expertise to take all of our auxiliary channels and do something amazing, because this is something that's really, really difficult right now. We don't have the person power or the expertise for it, quite frankly.
Opening up those auxiliary channels would be a really good thing to do, because I've been talking to some computer science people, and there are people who don't care about gravitational waves at all, but they care about machine learning on large data sets, and this is a wonderful thing.
Wonderful.
Just as a comment, we do have a machine learning pipeline that has distributed probabilities that there is an un-Gaussian noise transient alongside the low latency HFT. So there are very well-developed efforts inside the collaboration that do this. If you want to know more, I'll talk to you here off about it.
From my perspective, as a search person, these things still come through the analysis, regardless of whatever flags we've coming. If I'm looking at events coming out from our search pipelines, they generally will often look like this. There's a lot of good work that goes into reducing these and worrying about them, but we have to be able, regardless of what happens in terms of pre-data processing, we have to be able to deal with things like this at the search level. So let me move then from having given a little bit of a background into what we're looking for and what we're looking for it in. Let me talk a little bit then about how we actually search for them. So just go back. I know some of you may have heard some of this before, of course, but the basic idea of our search relies around the idea that if you have Gaussian well-described noise and you know what you're looking for, this is a well-posed and solved problem. Match filtering basically means if you take your data and whiten it to effectively remove the noise curve from it, you can then multiply the signal by the data and sum it up, right? That's all you're doing. At any point where this becomes large, I mean, you've got Gaussian noise, you're convolving it with something that's normalized, so what comes out should also be Gaussian. You see something that's not, like it has a value that's larger than what you'd expect from Gaussian noise, then it's probably likely not to be Gaussian noise. To be clear, this statistic is asking the question, is the data most consistent with Gaussian noise or with the signal model? So if the data looks like that, and you ask the question, like, is it more consistent with Gaussian noise or a signal, you're going to get an answer that's going to go one way or the other, and it will go one way or the other pretty strongly. So that's kind of why we have to worry about the glitches here. If the data were Gaussian noise, and we understood the noise curve and it wasn't varying like it does, the search would be reasonably simple at this point. The only thing we'd have to worry about is the fact that we have this 15-dimensional parameter space that we have to search over, and this becomes a computational problem. To deal with this, we look at analytic, to take an analytic description of the waveform. You can maximize out about 11 of these parameters. You make a number of assumptions. We pretend precession doesn't exist. We pretend eccentricity doesn't exist. We pretend high-order waveform modes don't exist. And there's papers I can talk to people about what these assumptions mean, because a lot of the work I do is in trying to relax those assumptions and go after those types of signals. That's something I'm particularly interested in. But if you make the assumptions that we make in the search, you can maximize over all of the extrinsic, the orientation, and whatever parameters. And then you're just left with the things that really matter, the two masses, because they intrinsically change the evolution of the system, and the angular momenta, which, as you've assumed, isn't precessing, just has two values for the two bodies, and they can be up or down, because we're going to allow anti-aligned spins just as much as we're going to allow aligned spins. Then you just want to search over lots and lots of waveforms, and you do this by creating what we call a template bank, which is just a large set of waveforms. There's a lot of work in the literature going back a number of years in developing methods for placing these sets of waveforms. Originally, this had to be restricted to just searching over the masses. In initial LIGO, we pretended that spins weren't there at all. As a new method for advanced LIGO, we were able to include the aligned spins, and this becomes a four-dimensional search now over the full parameter space with about 400,000 waveforms. Here's a plot of this compressed down onto, because I can't do a 4D plot, onto a two-dimensional mass one, mass two plane. There's a lot of structure in here which goes down to some of the internal details about how we've placed this. But you can certainly see regions where there's lots of points and regions where there's not. For example, here where the mass ratio is high, especially neutron star black holes, you need a hell of a lot of waveforms to cover the space. But for binary black holes, where we're seeing systems, you don't really need that many points at all. They're quite short, they're quite well described. And we'll sort of come back to that later. But at least with a sort of set of waveforms like this, you're going to lose no more than about 3% of signal power for a signal anywhere in the full parameter space. That's the criteria by which we construct this, and that's what we use. We could then assess the significance, is anything real, just from what comes out of doing this search, if the data were Gaussian noise. Given that it's not, you have to then start worrying about the non-Gaussianities in the data. So we do this by effectively a set of ad hoc tests, which are designed to look at the data and say, is this more consistent with a real signal or with some non-Gaussianity? There's a few different things that are used here. Here's just one as an example. You can say, look, here's a waveform. Let me split it up into, in this case, seven parts. My boxes aren't very good, but this is constructed in reality such that each of these boxes would contain 1/7 of the total signal power. You can then search using only this 1/7 of the waveform and see what signal power you recover. If you get roughly 1/7 up to errors, then that's consistent with a real signal. If you have some non-Gaussianity where maybe it just goes through one of these boxes, I guess the box would probably line up better in reality, but didn't get any power in, say, some of the edge boxes, this would be an indication that you probably have some sort of non-Gaussianity in the data, and you can sort of express this in terms of a chi-squared test. And we found this to be very powerful, certainly for binary neutron stars. It becomes more difficult when you get to higher masses. But this has been a very powerful test in distinguishing between these two things, and you can sort of go into the papers for more details of some of the other things that we do. From there, the remaining question then is, if I try to do this distinguishing thing, it's going to be good, but maybe it's not perfect. I can't be 100% sure I've removed all the non-Gaussianities. So then how do I decide if something in my data is real or not? The first thing we demand is that any potential event is seen in at least two detectors. So here's an example of me having this blue, let's say, is Hanford, and let's say this red is Virgo. And I've searched one of these waveforms through the data, and these triangles, or the star, indicates a point where the output, this match filter output, was larger than some predetermined threshold. And here's the same with Virgo. At most of the point, these diamonds don't line up, but here they're at the same time. So this is a star. We go, well, this potentially is a gravitational wave event. I retain this. It now becomes a potential signal. I then have to ask, how likely is this to be a real gravitational wave, or how likely is this to have come from background? We would just turn the universe off and operate LIGO for about 1,000 years in that mode. This has obvious difficulties. For this reason, our background estimation is not trivial and comes with some problems. So the way we do this at the moment is effectively you take the Hanford and the Virgo set of triggers and you just push one of them forward in time. You effectively retime all of this, add, say, 10 seconds onto it. This time offset must be larger than the light travel time between the instruments by a reasonably significant amount. So then if I shift it, and now these two diamonds, which I think are these two, which that one and that one actually, that obviously aren't at the same time and clearly is not two parts of the same real gravitational wave event, If these line up in time, then this is a sort of measure of my background. This is a background event. I can repeat this with numerous different time offsets. I can do this hundreds of thousands of times. So and then I can obtain a sort of background measure that's hundreds of thousand times longer than my foreground. There is a potential problem with this, which is that at some points my diamonds are going to start lining up with my stars. So I am going to get background events that are my real signals appearing in the background itself. And this is a problem. But we hope that these events are at least loud enough that they can sort of overcome this. If we then identify something as real, you can throw it out from the background for the quieter stuff. So you can sort of do a hierarchical removal process by which you identify events, remove it from the search, and then try to assess the significance of the next event. Finally, before I move on, start moving on to the main part of this, because this is something that the IAS group have touted quite a lot, let me say a few words about non-stationarity. Our basic idea to cope with non-stationarity is that we keep remeasuring the noise power spectral density. We keep measuring the sensitivity of the instrument. We don't want signals in the data to appear in the measured sensitivity of the instruments. You can't do this on like a second time scale, because if there's a signal in there, it will just appear in your PSD and you'll just think that's noise and not real. So we use a method known as Welch's method every 512 seconds. The basic idea is you take 512 seconds of data, you chop it up into 4-second blocks, you Fourier transform each of these, take the amplitude, and average them using a median. This gives you an estimate of the power spectral density, which shouldn't be too biased by the presence of a signal. There are small bias factors that come in, but these should be small enough, and we can demonstrate they're small enough that it doesn't matter. What this does mean, though, that if the noise curve changes on timescales less than 512 seconds, which it does, it will impact sensitivity. It will not affect the validity of a significance measurement. That sentence might have been written when I was talking to a slightly different, responding to a slightly different paper. But, okay, it's probably not so important here, but it's at least worth pointing out that even if this kind of thing does happen, it doesn't really invalidate the significance that we're doing. And then it's just a case of let's chuck all of this together. So we can then go through, for all of these events that we have, these are sort of the orange squares, which is number of events, 0 up to we get about 11 in this case. The black line here is the search background, which includes a real gravitational wave signal. So you can see that this sort of excess here is all the gravitational wave being found in time shifts with other things in the data, which causes a large tail. The purple line is what you see if you exclude the real signal from the data. And the gravitational wave signal 150914 lies way out here to the right of any background. We sort of said this was 5 sigma, but if you use this curve, which you probably should, and sort of extrapolate it down here, you'll get to something like 34 sigma or something ridiculously small. This event is ridiculously loud and it's clearly a real event. What we're looking for is more like events over here, which is actually our first result from what is now GW151012, which at this point was standing out above the background, but not so much that you go, wow, look, it's over here at 87 sigma. The IAS is more looking for events actually that lie here. So we're now way back in the noise curve from where we were in 01, and we're looking way down into the data with respect to what we were doing at the start of Advanced LIGO. So this sort of shows that not only have they been pushing, we've also pushed back as well. Our background curves don't look like this anymore. The sort of LIGO results are also pushing back. So there is continual improvement in trying to remove the search background while retaining real signals. So what can you do to distinguish them? And we validate the analysis by basically simulating lots of signals, putting them into the data, and trying to recover them. Here's just an example plot that shows that we are recovering signals. Without going into any details about what this plot is showing, it's the sort of thing we would look at, having put simulated signals in the data, and go, yes, there's no nasty things on this plot. I'm happy that my search is doing what I think it should be doing. Okay. How does the IAS analysis compare? So, I could have largely used these set of slides and not been talking about the analysis I developed at all. I could have been using these slides to describe the IAS methods, given that this was sort of a rather broad introduction in terms of not going into technical points on too many things. When you dig into the technical points, of course, as there are differences between the pipelines within the collaboration, they've been using collaboration vectors, there's differences with this method as well. For example, the construction of their template bank is different. Actually, a cute solution. It solves a problem that we didn't manage to solve back in 2012 in a paper that Duncan and I wrote, which is nice because that stopped us. Given the plots in their paper, I actually think our construction of our bank is doing better, but I think this is due to a computational restriction. I think they're maybe fitting onto fewer cores than we have available, so maybe we've taken slightly different decisions based on that. Our methods for distinguishing instrumental artifacts differ. They've developed a sort of new set of suites for doing this, especially for trying to identify these transients. I think there's real interesting stuff we can look at here and potentially try to incorporate ourselves.
So, Ian, are you going to go through these points later, or are you just listing them?
I will not go through these in too much detail. In a couple of cases, especially here, the paper that describes this isn't out. So in a few cases, I can't describe them in too much detail because I don't know it. But I can expand on these points as people are interested. So I'll leave that up to the audience as to how much detail you want me to go into here. Or if you want to ask questions about any of these, or if you just want to come and find my office and talk about this later. Either of these approaches work for me. They do have one thing they've touted as sort of being important is they have a new method for identifying times of non-stationarity, so times when the noise PSD is changing over a sort of short period of time, and correcting for it. So the details here are in a paper that's not public, but from what I think is going on, they'll sort of take the signal-to-noise ratio. If the power spectral density is changing over the timescale, they'll sort of push it down according to some correction factor based on the variance, the unknown, the error in the PSD estimate being higher than the average. I think that's what's going on. I'll note that we have been developing a similar method. Laura and a student in Portsmouth, Simone, have also been working on this. They've pretty much scooped us on this, but that's fine. I mean, people are thinking up different methods, the same methods at the same time. This is good, the ways of improving this. It maybe demonstrates there's something we can get out of this, so we'll continue looking into this as well. Maybe a slight different philosophy. They've sort of said, well, look, Leigerberg has probably seen anything if it's loud, right? If it has a signal-to-noise ratio of, say, 20, like some of the first detections, they've probably seen it, right? They're going after. They're also trying to make sure we don't miss anything. The neutron star black holes that are processing, we don't want to miss. It was always about the first detection, right, for us. We didn't know what we were looking for. They're able to say, well, look, Leigerberg has searched this data. They found 10. Mostly we found black holes. So let's go after the real quiet stuff, right? Let's tune our search so that the thing we're really going to try and find are the quieter things like what's already been seen. And to my mind, this, of course, is my impression, I'm speaking on behalf of myself, of course, but my impression is that's what they focused on, right? They're trying to go into and find the binary black holes that we didn't pull out from the published LIGO analysis.
Yeah, can I ask
yes.
a question? I think it was the previous slide. You had some plot that showed from LIGO a large-scale simulation campaign that demonstrated that we saw what we thought we saw, and then that is used in order to calculate the volume of the universe you're sensitive to.
Mm-hmm.
Skimming through their papers, I don't see anything equivalent. Mm-hmm. Does that worry you?
Yes. It has in communication with them, which has happened through a few other people like Tom Dan or Alex Nitz, has also been talking to them. This has been one thing that we've said we'd be interested, certainly be interested in seeing a plot that looks like whoops, sorry. The laptop, where are you going? Ah, no, don't show the results. No, stop it. Okay, I don't want to.
It might be worth just telling people what that plot shows for people. Because when I see that, I'm like, oh, I know what that is. But
yeah, let me go into this. I did try and deliberately not explain this. So what we've shown here is I've simulated around 100,000, 10,000 or so simulated signals. The chirp mass of the signals is shown here on the x-axis. These include processing signals, different waveform models, you name it, we'll pick signals. Whatever you tell us we should be looking for, we'll put into something like this. We add it to the data, and we perform a search where we just tell the search to forget it knows that there's a real signal there, see what significance comes out, and then plot it here. So the y-axis is actually the decisive optimal SNR, which means the signal-to-noise ratio in the second most sensitive detector, which is generally a good way of setting a solid bar on the y-axis. Most important.
The expected SNR based on the simulation. It's nothing to do with observation, right?
Correct. Correct. Sorry. Yeah, it's the expected signal-to-noise ratio. With a few caveats. I wouldn't use that word exactly, but yes, it's for first order. It's the expected signal-to-noise ratio in the second most sensitive, the second largest expected SNR. The important thing is that the color, which shows the false alarm rate, dark blue means greater than one per. You're not going to see something like this in the background in 10,000 years. This is clearly real. To the red, which is you're going to basically see this every day or every hour or every second, right? These red circles here are not real. The red crosses we didn't see at all. They were not recovered as an event. We did not find two things at the same time.
I don't see the cross.
Sorry?
I don't see the red.
Anything down here is a cross.
There's a handful of circles down there. Look behind the
inner. That's a circle.
You can see the crosses at the end, but they all just blend together.
Okay, I thought that.
Here's the interesting region, right, where we're going from it's clearly real to we didn't see it. We recovered something, but the significance lies somewhere between 5 sigma and it not being interesting at all. And really the goal is to sort of push this down to make these sort of lighter bluer circles dark blue, these green things bluer. You just want to push everything sort of down here. And you also want to make sure that you're not... If we had a spike of red crosses here, right, which are we missing signals at this particular point, or pretend maybe we're missing all the processing things, right? We can see that from these kind of things, right? Like Steve said, this really is a validation that we can use for many things. We could put eccentric waveforms in here, right? This is kind of how you do the plot that was being shown, right? You could put eccentric waveforms in here, show eccentricity on this axis, and you'll see blue, and then it'll go red. So you'll see how we're not able to find eccentric waveforms where the eccentricity gets high. These sort of codes are pretty flexible, so you can do whatever you kind of want with these types of analysis. And we have toolkits to do kind of different types of studies that I can talk to people about if they're interested. But the bottom line is that this can be used to validate our sensitivity to particular populations of signals. This type of result has not appeared in the IAS papers. I would like to see them. From discussion with the group, I understand that they are putting in simulated signals and checking their various consistency tests against them. So they're saying, well, we put them in and make sure we're not going to throw out that many signals in the process,
which is
a nice test, but it isn't quite it's sort of getting towards here, but it would be nice to see something like this as well.
Yeah, I mean,
or a VTE measurement, I agree.
I mean, the big thing, you know, if you look at this plot, you can see, you know, decisive optimal SNR of 10, right? Everything in the search pipeline is absolutely found, right? Has a false alarm rate of better than 10 to minus 4.
9.
Or with a couple of little dots there, right? But so basically the IS is saying, you know, all that stuff is allowed to be found by LIGO, so we're willing to miss a lot of that blue stuff to push down into the red stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly say anything above here we don't care at all about. That's the line they put in their papers. The question is whether, I mean, because we don't see plots like this, it isn't quite clear where this actually lies right in reality. But here's the line they're claiming in the paper, 30.
Oh, so they just say they ignore everything above
30. They basically say above
30. They actually say we're happy to design a pipeline that misses stuff above 30. Right, so they don't find 59 out of 40.
Can I ask a light back question? So to make this plot, do you use the information? So do you go through the process of comparing with the background?
Yes, we do.
That is what the false alarm rate also.
Yes, we even add the injection into the background, slide it against the non-injection results, and put those in so that you're accurately simulating the effect that the simulated signal would have on its own background. We're the only pipeline that does that.
For example, is this the way in which you can you actually quantify, for example, the improvement going from O1 and O2,
This is where our VT results come from. When we're quoting VTs in papers, this is where it comes from.
Yeah, pick a false alarm, right?
I mean, of course, you're taking the numbers that come into the plot, of course, right? But the information that goes into this plot is exactly the same information that goes into the rates, upper limits or lower limits or whatever.
I should know this, but do we have this plot in some of the LIGO papers? LIGO VHF?
There's a version of this plot in the 1509-14 companion paper, but they're typically not published.
Because this is actually a quite interesting plot, I would say. I mean, you were complaining that they don't have a plot like this in that paper, but
we don't have that.
I mean, so most of our pipeline, our pipeline methods papers contain this. So their pipeline methods paper does not contain this. Which I would like to see it.
To be fair, Alison is right. We never published this plot for the O1 or O2 searches.
Yeah, I never saw that. It's quite interesting, actually.
You can certainly put more. Yeah, there are. We have them,
and if they ask for them, we can give them to them. And they don't have them and can't give them to us, but we haven't.
Yeah.
And the plot depends on the PSD and the
noise
at the time. So.
Well, yeah, it's a result of your search. If you're making it on data that hasn't used that PSD, I agree. I think that was your point. Sorry,
yes.
I missed that.
Ian, then, to follow up, if they're not doing large scale, as we've talked about, to estimate our rates and what have you, we use something like this, to actually say, if there was a huge population of binaries in the universe, what fraction would we see, and then we use that to normalize the rate. If they're not doing that, what are they using to do rate estimates?
They're using our rates. So what they're saying is, look, LIGO has a limit of sensitivity about here. It's actually about here, but whatever. They're saying above this point, LIGO has observed 10 binary black hole systems. So from here, we can infer that sort of in this region, you'll have this many signals. This is going to go as DQ. It's not really even an extrapolation, unless you're going to assume they're not isotropic, which they should be. But the basic idea is you can kind of measure the rate density at this point from the 10 systems we've got. You know this goes as DQ, so just extend it downwards.
But if I remember correctly, even in the abstract of one of their papers, they quote a lower FAR than LIGO. So they must have computing that in some
way. FAR is a property of a specific event.
Yeah, the point is, because their search is targeting these systems, right, you can remove background events that our pipeline might have kept in, because maybe it's consistent with a signal up here. So because they're doing a different search, they're tuning their various cuts, etc., in different ways, they are maybe achieving sensitivity lower here than we are. That's
related to some events, but local.
Right, for a given event, yeah.
Yeah, for a given event, and they must have a way of assessing that they can have a sensitivity.
Their false alarm rate estimate is done in the same way that we do it, by time sliding.
You don't need to do injections to estimate the false alarm rate. The false alarm rate is measured by the time slide. So when you calculate the false alarm rate, what you're doing is you're doing a map between detection statistic value and false alarm rate. You don't need to do injections to do that.
I thought that maybe this plot here is also telling us which is the expectation, I mean, which is the threshold on the FAR that we would consider appropriate for claiming that the event was statistically significant.
It's not the right interpretation. This says for a given software injection, this is the FAR of that event. Right? You can make your mind up about when you claim, you know, 1 in 100 years is significant or 1 in 1,000 years is significant.
So this is just telling you for a given population, how sensitive is our search? If at your mass 20, you know, this is
what it's really saying is, at what signal to noise ratio am I going to be claiming detections?
So how far out you go?
Right. This is a sensitivity plot. So this basically says, you know, I do the search, and I want to know how sensitive the search is. I do a bunch of each one of these simulated software injection. You do it into the data at the time. You calculate what it should be based on the PSD of the detector at that time. You get its SNR. You look up for the search, the map between signal to noise ratio and false alarm rate. You color that thing as it would have this false alarm rate, or it would be this. Right. That then you can turn into the VT plot and say the sensitive full volume of my search is this, right? So it's a measure of the sensitivity. If you did a crappy search, that red stuff would all move up. And, you know, it doesn't tell you the false alarm rate that you claim detection at. It says for a given SNR, for a given search, this is what the sensitive volume is. You still have to pick some FAR you're willing to claim detection at, or a PS.
A false alarm rate maps directly to a sigma, so you can get stuff from there. And then you can put Piastro in if you want. But that's really this, and then the Piastro are really the two numbers, which don't depend on the population.
Okay.
there's two key plots that come out of the pipeline. There's the foreground background plot, which is the map between S and R bar, and then this plot that says, you know, this is how well that search performs to an astrophysical population.
Well, it is true that, so the optimal SNR on the y-axis, that's just calculated from the parameters of the injection.
Right? We did remake the injection, yeah.
Yeah, so it is, like, this is kind of telling you, if you follow, like, that blue line, a mapping between the SNR and the false alarm rate.
Yes.
For, like, a given.
Yeah, you can, yeah, exactly. You can map the signal-to-noise ratio to detectability effectively. Let me.
But that's not how that number is measured.
Yeah. But you can, like.
You can interpret it from this plot, yeah. Cool.
Okay, yeah, so another important technical difference, which I will highlight because I think there's a big thing in this, is that when they do their search, they split it into a number of regions. Let's focus just on binary black hole. So what they've said is, look, we're going to split the search into four distinct regions of chirp mass. We will, five, sorry, I can't count. Zero. For each of these regions, we will place a set of waveforms that covers that region, and we will search in each of these independently. These will be considered separate searches. In each of these searches, each waveform will be treated equally, so you'll put in a prior that basically says, I expect to see signals equally for any point in that region. This is very similar to how our search works, except we use one region covering the whole space and do the same thing. So what it means is that we expect, and this is silly when I say it, we equally expect a detection here in the hundreds of thousands of NSBH waveforms with stupidly large mass ratio, as we do here where there are binary black holes. This obviously seems silly. If you were just restricted to the binary black holes, this might make more sense. But here, you have about 50 waveforms. Here, you have maybe 120 or something waveforms. And here, you have about 10,000 waveforms going down. So by splitting it into these regions, even if I was just to do a BBH search and treated every template equally, I would be looking at, say, 30, 40,000 waveforms. By just looking at regions 4 and 3 directly, I'm looking at about 50 waveforms, and then at about 120 waveforms. So why is this important? Well, here's the set of signals that LIGO has seen so far, the LIGO detections. There's the BNS over here. Here's the binary black holes, and they seem reasonably well spread. There's a lot of templates here in Bank Zero, and we haven't seen anything there, so that's a bit of a problem because we're putting a lot of our search effort here. But it's reasonably well spaced over the rest. The IAS detections, and I don't know exactly where they are, so I'm just sort of drawn them in the box. So they don't actually look like a square.
They don't report M1 and 2. They don't report chirp mass. You can put them on a line of constant chirp mass.
They don't report what their pipeline sort. They report their parameter estimation results, which is different.
Fair enough. Okay.
Well, point is putting those on here. It's not the same thing, and they may even move outside of the regions in the process. Here's where they occur, right? 4 in bin 4. And 3 in bin 3. This is the region where we only have about 200 templates, which in our search is polluted by all the stuff that's coming from here. So in our search, there's about 40,000 templates covering this collective region. They're doing a very focused search on these two things. So to say it in short, they're effectively doing a really focused search here and here, and quite a focused search in the other regions as well. But here, where you only have 50 waveforms, your effective number of degrees of freedom is going to be less. And this SNR, if we go back to our injection plot, at which you'll get blue circles, is going to be lower than in any of these regions, because you've just got less points here.
So Ian, I have a question. I think I understood this from talking to Barak, but so we, in 01, the LIGO search, before we had Tom's method for constructing the bank density stuff, the 01 search actually had three bits, right? There was low, medium, and high mass bin. And a lot of discussion about, okay, you have to divide by 3 because you have a trials factor. They're not dividing by 5, right? They're treating each of these completely independently.
The results that they quote and the results that I'll compare it against are not dividing these by 11 or 5,
right.
11 if you take all of them. But their p-values,
that's fine, right?
Their p-values should take that into account. So you can take from that what you will. You could argue, in my case, I'm only going to search here. right? I'm going to ignore the rest. So I've only got a search factor of 2,
right.
With a caveat, which will come in my last slide. So my idea is, right, can I take the PyCDC search pipeline, take the same philosophy, and reproduce the results of the IAS, but particularly, let's just focus here.
So all you're doing is changing the bank, you're not changing any veto.
So what I'll do is I'll use the IAS template regions, just 3 and 4, and I'll treat these separately. And I'll use our template placement codes to cover them. Maybe I'll place them a little denser than I normally do. I don't think that matters. One big change to the PyCBC search, which is the thing I've worked on, is before we were only able to store single detector events with a signal-to-noise ratio as large as 5.5. When the detectors become unequally sensitive, this became a problem in O2. We started missing events because of that. Making this lower was a problem. You had to deal with data storage issues because you start storing a hell of a lot of things. We've solved that now. So we're now able to store single detector events with signal to noise ratio as low as 4. I've also taken their philosophy that every single cut, I've just tuned it to be really aggressive. Right? Any cut that we've applied anywhere in the search, I've tuned. I've just made it harsh. Right? Processing waveforms gone. We're not going to be finding them. I don't care. If it remotely doesn't look like any of our template waveforms, gone, I don't care about it. I've included Simone and Laura's non-stationarity monitor. Any times where this is bad, gone. Just cut them out. I don't want them. So I've taken a sort of philosophy here that I don't care about anything that doesn't look like subthreshold binary black holes. That's what I'm searching for. That's what I'm going to try and find. It doesn't look like subthreshold binary black hole mergers. Our broad search would have seen it, right? Our other search. I'm now trying to develop a search that's almost targeting these types of things. I'm also not going to quote Piastro's. The main search result is the rate of false triggers, this false alarm rate, and that's the thing that's most easily comparable between the two. You could quite directly apply their false alarm, their Piastro calculation to ours, and you'd get the same sort of numbers. So I'm not going to do that because I do want to try to compare directly. And finally, here's their results. Here's the 6 triggers. I didn't do 01, sorry. Here's what they quoted in terms of 1 per year and not normalizing by a Charles factor of 5. So this is 1 per every 1,000 years per individual search. This one is really significant. They say 1 per every 1,000 years. This one, 2 at 120 years. And then these 3, which are becoming much more marginal at this point, 1 every 5 years. With 5 searches, you'd expect to see some of these, right, given that there's 5 bins. 1 every 2 years, 1 every 1.5 years. Maybe the chance that all of these are real is not so high. But the chance that you have these 3 together, the chance that one of them is real would probably be quite away from 0. Right? So in some way, you've almost got a detection through due to a bulk set of triggers here, I think. Here's what I see. The GW170121, I get 1 per 10,000 years now. Order of 10 less. This now is looking pretty significant from this search, which is good. That's pretty good. For 170304, I got 1 every 2 years, much lower. I put a star. After I cut, I noticed that at this time, this region of O2, I was struggling with very high mass templates. The total mass, 150 things, were picking up a lot of background. I just cut them out to see what that did, and that made the false alarm rate down to 1 every 16 years. So I put a star, and that's biased, because I'm tuning based on what I'm seeing. But I am struggling here to deal with the very high mass template, so I just cut them out and saw what happened. For 170727, 1 every 120 years to 1 every 26 years, I note here that the background estimate, this one's happening near to August. It has all the August events in it. But the background estimate here has actually been polluted by loud L1 single events that are not yet claimed gravitational wave events. I'll come back to that. But the background estimate here has a really horrible tail due to a couple of, let's say, interesting things that we're noticing in the L1 data. 0425, 1 every 5 years to 1 every 1 year. This event doesn't quite seem consistent in the 2 detectors from some of the follow-up plots that I've been looking at. But I mean, we're within an order of magnitude here in the estimate. 170202 went from 1 every 2 years to 1 every 4 years. This one went from 1 every 1.5 years to 10 every year. So I lost this one. I didn't really pick up at all. It doesn't look good in Hanford. So we like to look at plots like this in LIGO. It's called a Q-scan. It's effectively a spectrogram with some clever stuff on it to make real signals stand out. I'm starting to run out of time, but I'll quickly walk through these for the six signals in question. Here's the loud one, 170121. I look at that and I go, well, you think it's real, Laura?
Yeah.
It looks quite chirp-like. We tend not to see things like this in our data.
Can I ask a very stupid question? When y'all are doing this with the template bank search, there is a range in chi-effective, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So when you say there's like 50 templates in this range, is that just in that M1, M2, and then there's a third dimension?
That's covering the four-dimensional parameter space. We do a four-dimensional template placement, M1, M2, and the two individual spins, and it's 50 templates to cover all of it.
Ooh. These things have like five cycles, right?
Yeah. But also, like, some of the so this one, at least if you believe their posteriors, has a reasonably negative chi-effective, and those tend to, I mean, those look really flat, right?
No, this is like minus 0.3 plus or minus 0.3.
The really high negative chi-effective one, I think, was the trigger in 01, which I'm not looking at here.
It was the really high chi-negative was the least significant one of 02.
Okay.
And the 01 trigger they claim was high on the line. But that was, like, P of... P after of like 75%.
Also the parameter estimation value, maybe not the template bank, could be very
different.
Yeah. I mean, what it sort of tells you, given that there's few templates, is we aren't going to measure the parameters particularly well, right? So you're seeing large error regions coming out of their parameter estimation, our parameter estimation. We aren't putting priors in, of course, to the search that sort of say, well, the spins are going to be small. So we are maybe putting more things out at high spins. But
so is the absence in H1 because H1 was particularly unsensitive at that time, or what was?
So this is quite early in O2. At this point, the relative sensitivity between Hamvert and Livingston isn't as large as it became by the end. It is consistent. So it is a little larger than you might have expected, given the results that are coming out. But it isn't. There's certainly many. Of course, you move the orientation. There's points where you can see it in one detector and not see it in the other. This doesn't become at the point where it's astrophysically unlikely. There is a sort of range, a normal range of detector sensitivity. Yeah, Livingston here is cropping up at about 9. Hamvert's coming up somewhere about 5.
So then are they the same quintiles in both?
They are.
Yeah. Even for 15 and 914, the ratio of the antenna patterns is about three quarters. So there's the first detection papers, there's a difference in the amplitude that you can see between the two detectors, and that's purely an antenna. So even though they're mostly aligned, you can still get, from reasonable parts of the sky, not small caustic regions, you can get differences. But that could easily push this between greenish.
The searches include, and their search indeed also includes a test that says if these relative numbers, amplitudes, and also phases start to get to a point where they're not consistent with physical signals, we'll start killing them. So we do have a test that if Livingston SNR is like 50 and Hamvert is 2, this is possible. You can align something really stupidly to do that, but we'll cut it because we'll say that's so unlikely.
So does that cover the false alarm rates, or are the false alarm rates just...
That goes into the false alarm rate calculation. The statistic that is used to rank events includes this information.
So if this is 9 and 5, then this looks consistent, because even this small time frequency volume 5 is pretty...
From our searches perspective, this is clearly real.
Yeah.
Here's 1703.
I wouldn't base that on those.
I'm saying we're showing these because we like looking at pictures, right? There's nothing quantitative about this.
We like
looking at pictures, right? 304... It gets worse as you go quieter, right? Here you can sort of see something in Livingston. Hamvert has some sort of weirdness here. It sort of goes the other way. This could be what's sort of pushing this one to slightly different masses, but, I mean, you can't rule it out by these plots. You're sort of getting to a point where these are now becoming quiet, and we're looking at almost Gaussian noise. 170727, this one has a reasonably nice trace in Livingston. At this point, Livingston's quite a bit more sensitive than Hamvert, so we don't expect to see something in Hamvert here. Not too loud. 0425 looks something like this. Now we're getting really quiet. 0202 looks like this. Take from that what you will. That blip in Livingston is not covering the template track, so will not be causing this event. We are getting quite quiet, so the normalized then, it is sort of normalizing itself to the fact that these are quiet, so you're sort of pulling out the noise a bit more at this point.
Yeah, can I ask a question? So, I mean, this blip that you're talking about, is this the case with the blip? the glitch?
I don't think so.
I mean, why they didn't, they also had that in their analysis, no? They could have seen this.
This is very quiet at this point, so I don't think this is at the point where you want to remove this. A potential signal here is sort of coming here. It'll probably be on that track, so this is not overlapping that at all. So you go, I don't care. I think that's the right decision.
Ian, it's probably worth labeling these if you show them again by what the SNR is in an individual detector and what the chirp bus is measured, because that's what you need to kind of interpret these plots, because you want to know how much SNR is and what time frequency volume.
Yeah, I was making these this morning, so I haven't had time to put everything on them. But yeah, you could certainly put waveform tracks. We have coded the waveform tracks on these things and annotate them, which would have been nice.
So just to follow up to Alessandro's point, it's also important to remember that your Vita definer file or whatever you sort of cuts you have is different than what IIS used.
That is not a true statement. We have released the veto information. And the veto information that I'm using is what they've used.
They veto on top of that, though.
They do veto on top of that. So do we.
It could be that they have an extra condition that cut out the little bright thing in Livingston. As part of their search, that Ian has not.
The little bright thing is not relevant. The little bright thing is not where the waveform would be. You can cut it out. You can not cut it out.
So
it doesn't matter.
The,
it wouldn't change any.
I'm not picking
if they
veto on time.
Because you said in the list there was one where there was a glitch, a bleep, but maybe it's not this one.
That's the next one.
Yeah, it's starting to look a little. At this point, it's starting to look a little bit nasty. Again, you can't really rule it out. I mean, I'm looking at these and I'm going, I don't really like the look of Hanford, but we're so quiet that I don't think we have even that much experience at looking at things like this. So we are not at the point where I can rule anything out or rule anything in. I can just say one of these looks really nice and these look like what they look like. Right? Here are some pictures of the data from which you are free to draw whatever conclusion you want. However you might want. One more plot. I said earlier that our background distribution in Livingston, in at least one of the periods I used, was quite significantly polluted by one event. That didn't happen just once. That happened multiple times, where I was seeing a background distribution that would be pushed off because one single event was louder than the bulk distribution. So if you have a set in single detector where it goes follows the Gaussian curve, and then one event is slightly louder than the expected Gaussian fall-off, it'll cause a noticeable effect in our background distribution. Here's what these look like. None of these are claimed gravitational wave events. These all look more interesting, in my opinion, than the plots I've just shown, which is why I showed six sets of plots to put these in context. These are difficult. They look chirp-like. They look interesting.
What kind of SNR do you get for these?
These are mostly around 8 or 9.
Single detector.
Nothing
in the other one.
Nothing in the other one. All the other one isn't on. Which makes it hard, right? I can't claim anything statistical about this other than they are the loudest in that month that I looked in or whatever it was. But we certainly would expect there to be things like this in the data. And these are things that are coming out. So in some way, I'm now tuning my search against the possible astrophysical contamination, right? Should I now be trying to pull these out to actually beat my background down a bit further? Because these are limiting our background measurement in a number of cases.
Actually, there's an interesting question there, which is, should you be including time when Hanford's not on in the limits and signals that you use to estimate the background? Because, yeah, you've got astrophysical pollution in your background there.
Yeah, you can choose to do that or not to do that. It is a tunable parameter, and there's an argument for both. Finally, what is the... Richard asked me. I'm just going to try and rush through to the end, and then, because I know we've gone a bit over, and then there can be questions. Richard asked me this. What is the sensitivity increase of the new search? As stated before, there's no VT for the IAS, so I don't know numbers, and I can't compare. And the correct answer to Richard's question is I don't know yet, because I have to do all sorts of proper, and I have to put the signals in, I have to put them into both searches and run them through. And this takes time, because the proper search with 400,000 waveforms is a little bit slower than if I only run it with 40. But what the hell, there's no LIGO internal reviewer in sight, so let's get out the envelope, right? Roughly, the network SNR needed to reach a false alarm rate of 1 every 10 years in the previous search after we tuned it. So at the end of 02, this got better as we progressed, was about 9.1. At about 9.1 network SNR, we would claim one per 10-year event. This becomes 8.3 in the new search when you restrict to 40 or whatever templates. And this seems pretty consistent between the two bins. There is a trials factor of 2 that I'm just ignoring.
So this is just reading off the SNR plot.
Just looking at the plot, yeah. I can divide these and cube them, and I get 1.32. So I say that's a 32% increase in sensitivity. I've ignored a bunch of things here. The IAS have made a similar measurement in their paper. It's larger than this, but they've made an assumption that doesn't hold for the LIGO paper because they've used the detail of the PyCBC search that is not a detail of the GST-LAL search, which means that their sensitivity was probably better, and it kind of invalidates a little bit a number that was quoted there. But here's a similar idea, and here's the number I get out, using basically the same method that was shown in the IAS to give the same number.
Just to be clear, when you say the new search, you mean the tweaks you did to PyCBC yep. to make it look more like the
Correct.
IAS search?
Correct.
But that difference came mainly from using this only the phi, the two divided
I've tried a few things here. The IAS group claim that the PSD variation is a big thing for increasing the sensitivity. So I turned it off. I turned it off in the PyCBC search. I turned off our PSD variation statistic. It may not be as good as theirs, I buy that, but I turned it off to see what effect it has on the PyCBC search. That's all I can do. I can't turn theirs on and off, I don't have access to it. And it's probably different anyway. If I turn it off, it doesn't change the picture at all. I get the same numbers. It is helping, it is removing background events, but it isn't meaningfully changing the picture that I've shown. So the big change is having gone from 400,000 waveforms to 40 waveforms. That's the big change in what I've seen. And it's my opinion that that's the trick here. That by doing a really focused search for the highest mass binary black holes, only for the highest mass binary black holes, you've really increased sensitivity a lot there. Now, they may have increased sensitivity at the other places as well, but I think at the most gain they've got is in this high mass corner of the parameter space, which is where all the new signals lie.
But can I see?
Yeah, what about cutting to SNR of 4? Surely that's done something.
The cut to an SNR of 4 has certainly increased the PyCBC sensitivity. I'm almost going back and trying to compare to an old search where we've done this. So my comparison of this number is with that in play.
That would probably make that worse.
It would possibly make...
Cutting the SNR wouldn't show up in that number. It would show up in the void, and it would show up in the...
Right. But I do have that, we have done those runs as well. They are there. They're mostly being done on Oak 3 for obvious reasons, which means I can't show them.
I just wanted to... So in the paper they had in April, at the end of the paper, they have a couple of figures where they actually try to evaluate improvement.
Correct.
Is it 30 of the order of 30%?
No, they were showing a significantly larger number that was closer to 100. So they've actually done almost the same calculation to get that number. The difference is that they have included the old SNR threshold of 5.5. We know that that's a big improvement. We know that we will miss real signals if we didn't do that. So when they're comparing, they are comparing to the O2 search that we've published from PyCBC, in which you would have got that increase. However, the other search pipeline, GSD-LAL, which is also mentioned in the LIGO results, did not use an SNR threshold of 5.5. They used an SNR threshold of 4. And a couple of the detections that we saw in that paper are not recoverable if you don't do that. So we missed, PyCBC missed a couple of injections, a couple of real signals that GSD-LAL saw for this reason. So that changes their picture a little bit because they probably might have wanted to compare against GSD-LAL that had done this or even drop one of the numbers that they've used in this comparison from 5.5 to 4 to almost try and compare to what we've... It might have been a more fairer number comparison to the other search, GSD-LAL.
But what is that number? Do you...
Their number's close to 100%.
Factor of 2.
100%.
Factor of 2.
I don't believe that number's quite right. I think we're maybe you may argue it somewhere in the middle. But
I mean, you can ask. It's fair to say, how many more did they find? And it gives you a very rough estimate of their sensitivity.
Yes. But that is not the number they. That is not how they try to motivate that. And of course that I think is a very wrong thing to do. I mean, you've got all sorts of.
If you do it that way,
with six, this isn't anywhere near enough.
30%-ish not factor of two-ish.
Here I've done it. Here is the number done in a very similar way to they've done, except I haven't penalized PyCBC for having set this single threshold of 5.5, which I think wasn't fair, because GSTL didn't do that.
I think the factor of two is optimistic in their comparison, and an actual BT study needs to be done carefully, and my guess is the number's going to lie somewhere between 30% and the factor of two.
Yeah, and I suspect this number will change dramatically as a function of their template regions.
Do you have a sense if these changes would affect the mapping between the FAR to Piastro? Like, is the now of 1 per 100 years?
Yeah.
That's still pretty much 100%.
I mean, I still dislike Piastro while we're dealing with 10 events. I still think that the errors on this are too high, and I would prefer to continue to stick with false alarm rates at this point, personally. But I think that you could take... I'm getting similar signal-to-noise ratios to what they're getting in almost all cases. So I think you'll just see the Piastros will scale by the false alarm rate measurements that you're getting, right? So if I'm seeing something with a false alarm rate 10 times smaller than what they're seeing, the Piastro will say it's 10 times more likely to be real. If I'm seeing a false alarm rate 10 times smaller, the Piastro will say the same thing, because the scalings here and the sort of rate of signals isn't going to change between the two, because we're basically seeing the same signal-to-noise ratio distribution. And it'll be a little different if you ran this through properly, and we'll probably try and get that one out at some point if we end up putting this somewhere public. But I think, to me at least, the more meaningful measurement is to look directly to these false alarm rate comparisons. I think that's the real thing that says, are these two comparable?
Can you go back to that table of the FAR measurements? Mm-hmm. All right, so if I pretend you don't record it, obviously 170121
is real.
Which of the others would you, if you were to force to pick, is it two or three?
I'd probably go with these two being real. Maybe this one, I've gotten a smaller number than this one, so maybe I'll put rank this one above that one. But one every 16 years, this is more significant than LVT 151012 when we first published it. So let's put some of these in context, right?
Yeah, LVT 151012 was one every 2 years.
Right. I mean, if you're on that level, then you've got this one as well, I think this one's real. Let's say one of these two. Maybe. There's probably less. I mean, we're getting to Piastro numbers that are pretty much representing what IAS put in their papers, right?
So, I know it's late. I just want to make a comment. Going back to one of your first what's the value in what they have done following this different philosophy of looking, more focusing on some regional parameter space? To me, or maybe it's your conclusion. Maybe it's different from yours. The advantage could be to try maybe to focus on in some regions of the template bank may pull out more quickly events that may be more interesting, but they are not very loud.
Maybe I can give my conclusions before they get preempted. Conclude. I'm able to largely reproduce the IAS results. Let me run through the last slide, and then I'll at least got to the end, and we can go for questions, whatever. The improvement in sensitivity, in my opinion, largely comes from a significant reduction in the search space. Certainly, these aggressive cuts are helping. They are going to reduce sensitivity to some systems, especially the things we haven't seen yet. So I wouldn't replace this with the current search. But more work to do on our side, definitely. I think the IAS is still beating us at very high masses. I think their cuts, et cetera, are doing better at finding the really high mass binary black hole mergers. I think the difference in sensitivity, if you push this to the highest end of bin 4, is worse for us. So I think we have to work on this more. From inspection of our loudest background events, there are result pages. If someone can tell me how to share these publicly, because LIGO websites are really bad at sharing things outside of LIGO, I can show you all the details. We are still seeing some events that are clearly not real in our background. So I look at the loudest background event and I go, that's clearly garbage. Why is it there? How can we get rid of it? And I'm seeing some events that may very well be real in our background. So there's two populations to worry about. One is more work on outside. The other one is a tricksy problem. But I think a targeted low amplitude binary black hole and BNS search alongside our existing broad parameter space search seems like a smart move in being able to observe the most binary black hole mergers. Warning. Here be bias. I have knowingly tuned the search to try to find things that I know are there. I have tried to reproduce signals that I'm being told are there. I have tried to do this in an unbiased way, but I have probably not made cuts that I think will remove these events from the search. Right? I know their parameters. I've seen the results of what's coming out. It is very hard when you have the data and results in hand to do things that are not biased. And it's very hard, as Steve said, it's very hard not to do this unconsciously as well. This doesn't just apply to me. This applies to every search that's coming from open data, including the LIGO searches, because the data is open to us right now on O3, right? And we're tuning on that. So unless you're going to say, here's exactly what I'm going to do, before the data is even taken, there'd be bias. But what I can do is I can tune this now on O2 data, and then I can look at O3. And at this point, this becomes LIGO.org only, sorry. The end.
So what about those things that were only found in Livingston? Is there any plan? I know people have murmured about doing, like, releasing single detector events, but sort of what's the status of that?
You already got one.
There are attempts to make single detector event detections. GW 1904-25, the BNS, mm-hmm. is a single detector event. I think that's clear from the result.
Virgo was on, and there's...
It's a single detector event. That's the pipeline's perspective on this. That's what GST allows
for. Localized to the sky.
It has used Virgo to help the sky map. That is too quiet. PyCBC is doing something here with the sub-threshold stuff, but meaningfully, it's coming from Livingston alone.
The instruments field is populated with what is on, not what was used in the...
Correct.
Yes. We had a big discussion.
The instruments field is populated with what is used for the sky map, which I think is the correct move because that's what astronomers want to know.
Actually, they also want to know how many detectors have been seen.
By the way, is this so
high? I could argue that that's not so relevant for sky map generation.
It's
on open data by people looking at it later. You're not making any statements about what LIGO will do.
You're so late, man.
That's great.
And
we don't need to talk LIGO policies internal here and now. Let's talk science.
What? Yeah.
Are you agree?
I have a question for Ian. My life is taken up with LIGO politics. I don't think we need to argue them here, too. But.
Richard, you're happy, right?
Okay.
Me being shouted at will happen this afternoon behind closed doors.
So you mentioned targeted BNS search as well. Yeah. Is the astrophysical template bank GST LAL search that was done on O1 data, is that something like what you mean by a targeted BNS search or something different?
Yeah, I mean, the idea here is the same sort of thing, right? Restrict your template set to the binary neutron stars or pull everything out in some way and just search for that. But this one's harder because the range of templates here is quite small, is large, right? You are still dealing with tens of thousands. It isn't going to cut down to 40. But if you just search for 1.35 plus 1.35 neutron stars, then you probably could tune this right down, right? So there are... This becomes harder with only one, two, maybe signals at this point, right? So we can argue a little bit about this one. The BBH one's maybe more motivated at this point, but I think you probably want to look there as well while we have signals, sort of focus in on that region as well. NSBH is going to be much harder. The parameter space there is too large, and I think this approach may not work there. But I think for the two if we can reduce the parameter space we're searching significantly to go after the signals that we're seeing, whatever they might be, you're going to see more of them.
And it's also some
Richard, what's this?
So, doing the, I love the tune search. We're going to need really accurate features of the variable parameter space, and that might mean a larger number of injections. Is that okay?
Yeah, we can get V2, it's fine.
Okay.
Ian, this tune search, I know Tom Dent and John Veach wrote this paper a few years ago, and they basically said, I'm going to search 100,000 templates,
yeah.
But each time I get a trigger in a template, I'm going to weight it by effectively the rate of signal I expect that template to pick up, right? And that's a less, you know, drastic approach than what you've done, where you've just thrown away 99.9% of the templates. In principle, it would do the same thing.
Yeah, I actually predicted you were going to ask that question. So I thought up an answer, and it started with, why don't we do it, right? Here's the end of the show problem, right? The IAS group actually have more people working on their search than any search within the LIGO collaboration, right? This is a problem, right? There are 1,000 people in LIGO. I should not be saying that. There is a problem. And the IAS group were shocked to find this out, right? We were talking to them and they said, you've got like 5 people working full-time on this. I barely struggle to manage one, right? So no one's coded up this method. It is a cool method. It has more complications that the paper did not address, which is the fact that the templates cover a large region of parameter space, and you have to sort of marginalize over this. Your neutron star black hole may be finding the binary neutron stars or similar things like this, right? That's the big thing the paper didn't address. That needs
you
more
do it
work.
Once per run, right?
Someone needs to do it.
Yeah. But you're
no one's
you don't have to do it every hour. You do it once and
yeah,
you work
yeah,
for
this is a post-run thing, right? It's not something you're doing live. You don't want to find these systems. They're not going to be AM observable or anything like that, right? They're too quiet. And the sky map's going to be terrible. But, yeah, if someone can work on doing that with the 1.5 FTE I have, we are focusing on making the search run in low latency. Right, that is where all the effort is gone for the most part, is making sure that doesn't fall over. Because if we miss something critical, that's our big science payoff that we can't lose sight of. So right now, that's where the effort is going necessarily. And I don't have manpower to explore anything else, unfortunately, which does leave other groups wanting to do this ahead of us, and that's a sad thing.
I mean, but isn't this why you want to, I mean, at some point you want to release data so that other people can try different techniques and then help you improve your technique? You know,
yes, it is. We certainly are. I mean, yes, this is a big payoff of open data, right? We are another group that has more person power available than we do, has taken this and gone, we actually care about this problem. And maybe we've learned something from this that we can apply directly into our latest data, and maybe our next catalog paper from LIGO includes more black holes than it would have done because of this. I think that is a reasonably likely set of affairs. Not that I can say.
And a positive outcome.
And a positive outcome, yeah. It's nice to see an external group pick this up and do some really cool stuff with it, right?
In terms of upweighting the significance of certain events because they look like what we expect the population to look like, I think that's also the point of a joint piastro population analysis. So I'm not sure that needs to be done at the search level as long as those things are still coming up as triggers in the data, then there's the piastro-based significance that folds in the parameter estimation would have the same effect as us saying, like, yeah, this is more likely to be real because we expect to see a bunch of 30-30 solar mass black holes, and this is a 30-30 solar mass.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that's not so trivial to fold in, the one thing that certainly isn't folded in any attempts at the moment, is the fact that the noise background around the very high mass is different. Normally when this is done, you sort of glump all of the triggers, all of the templates together, and create almost a combined noise background across the whole set. So you'll lose the information that there's very few templates at very high mass, and the noise background there is lower than lower masses. So, but you can, I mean, effectively you're doing that, then you're almost combining all this in. I agree that this sort of approach, combined with the paper that Steve referred to, would be a cute way of putting all this together naturally, actually, and getting these numbers out, because that's what comes out of the paper that the, John Beach and Tom Dent wrote, was they are looking to directly do what you've said. It's not trivial to get it in, and that's what we're missing, is the effort to actually get this in. But it should go, I think, at the search level, because you need information like, what is this waveform actually covering, right? If we found a template that's 100 plus 1, is that interesting? Well, it might be if that 100 plus 1 is covering equal mass binary black holes, because that's how our template bank placement sometimes works.
And that's when you get that, after running PE on that trigger?
You would not, because the PE uncertainties are not the same as the search uncertainties. They're much narrower. And sometimes there may also be a gap in our template bank, right, which you'll get out, which the PE won't know about at all.
But the problem is just that otherwise you might throw away that, or like that trigger wouldn't be significant enough to be kept in.
Well, you have to bring the piastro up properly, and that requires you knowing, A, that this might be a trigger covering an astrophysically relevant region of parameter space, although the trigger, the template parameters might not suggest that. You would need to know a local density of noise triggers, and of course you need to know the astrophysical population. But I think the if you combine these three things together, I think you get this naturally out. So I do think this is sort of the way to go. Without a lot of that infrastructure and without anyone working on doing it, cutting to something like this is something I can do in a day at KITP. The other thing, if I'm in a situation, which I'd like to be in, where I've got search people who are interested coming out the door, and what am I going to put these people on, then we'll be doing this, definitely.
Ian, so hypothetical science question. Let's say you wanted to add, and I'm just going to channel Richard here. Let's say I wanted to add another dimension to the search, but I only wanted to target it in a specific region of the mass space. Like, well, let's say I wanted to add eccentricity, but I only wanted to add 0.1 or 0.2 and in a specific region of mass space. So no eccentric neutron stars, no eccentric neutron star black holes. Is that something an independent group like the IIS could do relatively? Like, is that something that could be done in this sort of targeted search approach?
Yeah, the eccentricity is hard. I have a paper out which focused on higher order modes with Juan and others that describes a search technique that would be applicable to eccentric waveforms as well. A number of the reductions in the parameter space that apply when you are not dealing with eccentricity do not apply when you are dealing with eccentricity. So the standard search paradigm breaks and you need a new formulation of the match filter itself. Like the match filter maximized over extrinsic parameters. We have formulated such a thing, and I believe it would be a start at eccentric waveforms. If it doesn't work, you'd have to look at more clever approaches to the problem. The thing that maybe is limiting here at the moment is also waveform accuracy for these types of things. It isn't clear to me that we have a broad parameter space waveform eccentric approximate that would cover this. We're a little...
I think you could get away with that by saying that most of these things will be roughly circularized 0.1 or 0.2 by the time they hit the LIGO band. And then you can just use the stationary phase frequency domain stuff that like Nico Yunus has been developing.
What about the merger?
Well, I mean, by the merger, it's almost completely circularized. And by almost completely, I mean 0.01 or less than that.
But yeah, I'm
thinking about neutron stars.
I'm thinking about black holes.
I would definitely like to have someone working on this problem. It is a problem that I am interested in looking into. External groups, of course, if they have people available, could do this. There are subtleties. There are different subtleties to that problem, which is maybe that's a different talk entirely.